Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks very much for joining us. I recently had the great pleasure, and it really was a tremendous pleasure, to talk with Toby Meyer Fong about her new book, What Remains, Coming to Terms with Civil War in 19th Century China. This came out with Stanford University Press in 2013. I'll just say right off the bat, I loved this book. It's a wonderful book, not only for the historiographical contributions that it makes, not only for the stories that it's telling, but also for the really beautiful and thoughtful way that it's written. It's not just a really moving story, a really interesting story, but it's also a story, or rather a set of stories, that's really a great, great pleasure, really a pleasure to read. So Toby was generous enough to take the time to talk with me at the Association for Asian Studies annual meeting in Philadelphia, and we talked about various aspects of what's a very, very rich story. The story takes us into the history of, and really the deep history of, the Taiping Civil War or the Taiping Rebellion in the 19th century in China. And the chapters successively introduce texts and bodies of various sorts, bodies and parts, living bodies, dead bodies, commemorated bodies, textual bodies, physical bodies, that emerge from the really fascinating archive that Toby has found, has put together around and from and within the Taiping Civil War as a historical object. That archive includes some really interesting illustrated sources. It includes memoirs. It includes gazetteers. And she's very, very careful in the book to tell us about not just the events that emerge out of these archives and the stories and the characters, but also to take us into and really to teach us, I think, really interestingly about the use of, the richness of, and the importance of some sources, some categories of sources specifically for understanding this context of history that we might not otherwise think to use or think to work with and or think to treat in the very rich way that she does as sources of evidence for unearthing people, individuals, and also bodies and their stories in this period. So it's an extraordinary accomplishment. It's a wonderful book. I hope you have a chance to read it. I can't recommend it highly enough, and I hope you enjoy the conversation to come. I can say I absolutely and without question enjoyed it. It was a real pleasure, and it was also a real pleasure to read the book. So enjoy. I'm here today with Toby Meyer Fong to talk about her new book, What Remains, Coming to Terms with Civil War in 19th Century China. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Toby, and thanks for meeting with me in the midst of a really busy Association for Asian Studies conference. I loved the book, and it's really a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you about it.
It's really, really nice to meet you too, Carla.
Me too. So Toby, could you start us off, as is traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit about what brought you to the field, and specifically, how did you come to work on Qing China?
Well, actually, I had been a high school student with a strong interest in biology and English. And right before I went off to college, I got the course catalog and I looked at the course catalog. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, if I major in, if I go with pre-med, I have to do calculus and chemistry. And if I don't go pre-med, I can take anything I want. And I realized that anything I want didn't include either calculus or chemistry. It included a lot of history classes. So I started signing up for history classes and taking things on subject matters that had been covered not at all, not even a little bit, not at all, in my high school curriculum. And so I took History of the Soviet Union, and a friend of mine who was also taking that class said, you know, there's this great class that meets in this room immediately after. Why don't we stay? And it was Jonathan Spence's lecture class in Chinese history. And the way he did history really spoke to me. The fact that anything could be a legitimate primary source, including poetry and painting and novels, it seemed to me a really, and this was in the 1980s, so if you did literature, it was very theoretically oriented, right? Comp Lit, it was the height of the sort of postmodern theory, which I wasn't interested in. So history seemed like a way to read all kinds of things in a whole range of genres and analyze them without having a heavy postmodern theoretical apparatus. And Chinese seemed both really far away and really close. And at the end of the year, my sophomore advisor said, at the end of my freshman year, my future sophomore advisor said, if you're serious about history, you need a foreign language, French and German or Chinese or Japanese. And I had just taken Professor Spence's class, or it was just wrapping up. And I thought, it hadn't occurred to me that I could take Chinese.
Yeah.
And so I signed up for Chinese.
That's good. And it's so interesting because so many people that I talked to were brought into the field of Chinese history specifically by having a really inspiring teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really nice to hear that that was the case here as well. So so the book that we're talking about explores the remains in many senses and many registers of remains, literally and figuratively, and we'll talk about many of those, of what's typically known as the Taiping Rebellion in English, but we'll look at that and talk about that vernacular and vocabulary as well. And this rebellion or civil war, as I think we'll talk about, lasted from 1850 to 1864. So can you talk a little bit about how you came to this topic and how you decided to write this particular book-length object about this topic? So what brought you here in the trajectory of your research?
Well, actually, in a strange way, it's a follow-up to my first book, which is about the scenic sites. It's about the construction of scenic sites in the city of Yangzhou in the aftermath of the Manchu conquest of China, and how elite literary men built a landscape of famous sites that referenced the city's storied past as a way of gathering and coming together across a political divide between sort of people who still, even after the fall of the Ming, saw themselves in relation to Ming history, and people who were not averse to the new regime. And they built and wrote about and celebrated these famous buildings. And the book looks at several of these buildings. And as I was finishing the book, I realized that someone might call me to task for not having looked at the last 19th century gazetteer, which is a local history. And they come out at intervals. And I had looked at the last Ming gazetteer, and I had looked at all of the Qing gazetteers through the 1810 gazetteer, and I realized that, you know, I hadn't looked at the 1874 gazetteer, and someone might call me to task for not having completed the job. And especially since I knew that the Library of Congress had the book and that the Library of Congress was a 5-minute walk from my house. And so I thought, oh, I can't embarrass myself by failing to look at the book. So I walked up the street, got the book, and I thought, I'm going to take a perfunctory look at this and wrap up the project and send it off. And I opened the book and I looked up all of my scenic sites and realized that they had been destroyed in the mid-19th century in the context of the Taiping Rebellion. And then being sort of addicted to, you know, once you have a gazetteer in front of you, you want to see how it's different from its predecessors and what makes it special. And so I started flipping through the book. Nothing's ever perfunctory, right? So I ended up in the middle, in the biographical section, there was a section labeled Loyal and Righteous. And it referenced a handful of people who had died in the Ming-Qing transition, sort of during the context of the Manchu conquest. And then it very quickly moves to a list of people who died during the Taiping Rebellion and how their deaths could be construed as loyal to the Qing dynasty. And I started just rough out translating these. And they were so shocking because it basically gives you the place and the place of their death and how they died. So-and-so, such-and-such a status, died by what means. And just this litany of names and how they died for hundreds of pages, or what felt like hundreds of pages. And I thought, you know, I've taught the Taiping Rebellion. I've always thought of it in terms of the kind of kooky religious aspect of the Taiping Rebellion, because that's what interests students. Or I've seen it in the context of talking about it as an origin point of the communist revolution or as part of that historical genealogy leading to 1949. But I'd never really thought of the fact that it actually meant that huge numbers of people had lost their lives. And of course, for the authors of the gazetteer, the fact that their deaths could be construed as loyal to the dynasty justified their inclusion. But aside from that, just the vast numbers of people who died, then you can readily imagine through a leap of historical empathy the fact that those people had relatives, those people had children and parents, and then you realize the kind of the magnitude of the event. And I found the notes that I took on that day, and full of exclamation points. Someone needs to think about this. And then I realized that maybe I needed to think about it. And that's, so I wrote a proposal, and applied for grants and began thinking more seriously about how we would reconsider the event that we call the Taiping Rebellion, from the vantage point of the huge and almost incomprehensible level of death and destruction that accompanied that event.
And you talk early on in the book about the importance of reframing this as, or from the typical English vernacular for this event, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, the Taiping Rebellion, and instead considering it as a civil war. Mm-hmm. And that really does transform how we think about what happened and how it happened and to whom it happened and what the consequences were.
Good. And it also actually makes it a less of this peculiar, exotic Chinese event. It also actually allows us to divorce it from our way of thinking about rebellion, sort of late dynastic rebellion, or not thinking of it only as a late dynastic rebellion comparable to the late dynastic rebellions of the Tang. It allows us to think about it in kind of a more broadly comparative framework in relation to other civil wars that happened in the mid-19th century, including our own civil war. It allows us to kind of think of it in more humanistic terms, rather than this peculiar thing that happens in late dynasties in China. But it also allows us to think forward toward other instances of mass death in the 20th century, in China and beyond.
Right. And that, speaking of these humanistic terms, and I'll also say for listeners, if you hear some ambient voices outside, it's because we're in this lovely New Books in East Asian Studies hotel room. And so sometimes we'll get some, I'm sure, some commentary from the hallway, room service and such, and that'll just make it more exciting. But in the meantime, you just mentioned the importance of taking a kind of humanistic approach to this. And one of the things that you mentioned early in the book, and that really permeates the whole experience of reading the book, at least for me as a reader, was the effort to really try to encompass in some way or bring to the fore a range of voices mm-hmm. that were experiencing and dealing with this, this series of events, this really dramatic and really violent series of events. And you talk early in the book about the ways that using certain sources or and kinds of sources that maybe typically aren't integrated so centrally mm-hmm. into the story mm-hmm. of this series of events was really crucial for doing that. So could you talk a little bit about that? You mentioned already finding this gazetteer and the experience of that, reframing how you thought about this event. We can talk a little bit more about gazetteers and or if there are other kinds of sources that you felt are in general terms before we get to the chapters, really important in letting you access this range of voices. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, I mean, first of all, as a reader, I like books that allow me to encounter people across time and space, mm-hmm. that allow me to make connections and allow me to at least have some kind of window into people's life experiences. Because for me, I think that's what history is about. But also just in terms of the kinds of source materials that I like to work with, rather than approaching this as a kind of looking for statistics in the archive or looking for statistics in gazetteers or trying to get a handle on numbers, I really wanted to find stories of everyday experience. And one of the things that's actually really striking about this event is that it produced such a large number of memoirs, in English we would call them memoirs, a substantial number of which have been edited into punctuated compilations by scholars in the mainland, in mainland China. One volume came out in the 50s, and one 12-volume set came out in the 50s, another 12-volume set came out sometime in the last 10 years. I think it's 12 volumes. Don't hold me to the science on that.
Seven
but anyway, it's a very large multi-volume set. And these multi-volume sets are divided into big typing texts, materials from the Qing side, and foreign materials in translation. And I mean, the material from the Taiping side has been extensively made use of by scholars in China. The material that gets labeled by librarians and archivists and compilers as Qing side actually includes a wide range of material that's not explicitly located on the Taiping side. Actually, one of the things that I found in doing this research, I should probably put this right out there, is that our desire and the desire of Chinese scholars and desire, I think, of everybody, we like stories where there are good guys and bad guys. And we like the, you know, if there's a clearly identified good guys and bad guys, a fun way to tell the story is to reverse it. But one thing that I really left this research feeling is that there weren't good guys and bad guys. There were people with a very large range and spectrum of motives. There were people who changed sides for very opportunistic reasons, that the Taiping were not heroes, and that that people at the time were very profoundly aware of the extent to which the people involved in the fighting were not hardcore Taiping versus hardcore Qing. There were a range and a spectrum of fighting men fighting for different people, different organizations in different moments, that the boundary between soldier, bandit, and rebel is extremely permeable. And so that means that you can't easily categorize your source material into these, you know, the Union Confederate and foreign journalists. You can't say Taiping, Qing, other, as easily as we or they would like. But the sources included memoirs, diaries, poems, paintings, maps, gazetteers, morality books, a huge range of different kinds of material that wouldn't normally all be coexisting in the same kind of study. And actually that keeps it exciting as a researcher, because you get to work with a whole lot of different stuff. And sometimes just figuring out what something is can be an exciting part of the research.
Which maybe brings us nicely into the first chapter, because some of these sources actually are really exciting for the reader as well. And one of them is front and center in, or the second chapter rather, Words. We already talked a little bit about the introduction. So chapter 2 centers on a figure, Yu Zhi, who was a pro-Qing preacher and writer who claimed to represent the Qing to the populace. And over the course of the story of this chapter, we really see him and his understanding of an experience of the Taiping really changing over time. And this is manifest in some of the materials that are really, really fascinating that you show us that he's producing through this chapter. So to start us off, because I think we're going to spend a little bit of time on him because he's so interesting. Could you introduce him for us? Who is this guy and what do we need to know about him before we understand what he's producing?
Sure. He's a five-time failed examination candidate from Wuxi Prefecture, or from the Wuxi area. And he rises to extraordinary prominence for someone of his relatively humble elite beginnings. In some ways, in some ways that I don't entirely speak in the book, I just kind of put it out there. I see him as in his trajectory as being the Pro-Qing equivalent in some ways of the leader of the Taiping Rebellion himself, right? They're both failed exam. I mean, people put out there all the time, one of the standard lines is that Hong Xiuquan rebels against the dynasty because he failed the examinations. And I've always wondered about that. More people fail than pass, but not all of them have religious visions and think they're the son of Jesus Christ, right? So what about, you know, and we never admit the possibility that there's someone out there that fails the examinations repeatedly and yet still defends the dynasty and defends the moral vision that undergirds the Qing ideology, really, Qing political ideology. And he is someone who we were talking about this before, actually, Carla, is, you know, I thought, oh, I found this person that no one's ever heard of. But actually, he's not totally unknown in the Chinese scholarship. He becomes sort of emblematic of the sort of post-Taiping organization, articulator of a philanthropic vision. He becomes the kind of prototype of the kinds of Jiangnan philanthropists that Catherine Tarpley Egerton talks about in her book Tears from Iron, which is actually Tears from Iron is Ironman's tears. It's because his disciples actually wrote a book that is quite similar to the one that I look at in my chapter to help people to mobilize philanthropy in Jiangnan to help the famished during the strange famine of the late 19th century using visual materials. Okay, I'm going off the rails here, right?
No, that's great. So that for listeners who don't know what this Tears and Iron reference is to, one of the texts that is really fascinating that is a centerpiece of this chapter is an 1864 illustrated pamphlet called A Man of Iron's Tears for Jiangnan. And so to get to that, what we need to, or what readers maybe, or listeners need to understand is this is happening. He's living, he's working, he's having these experiences in a context where the written and spoken words are really, really important culturally, mm-hmm. socially, and materially. And maybe that's where we should start to bring us into A Man of Iron's Tears for Jiangnan. You talk in the book about this fascinating set of endeavors, societies organized to collect and dispose of paper properly. There's this environment of sort of revering the written word.
Mm-hmm.
And also being concerned with its pollution,
right,
that he's sort of part of and he's growing up in. And in understanding his role in this, you show us that it's not only the written word that's really important, but also the spoken word that's particularly important to him. So can you talk a little bit about that, his interest in... Well, maybe I'll just mention that and we'll get to the text because I really want to talk about this text. Okay, so basically the way to understand Yujiro, at least from the perspective of this reader, right? He's also coming out of this context where the written word is sort of talismanic mm-hmm. important. And he is envisioning this sense of community, as you put it in the book, which is constituted through and bound by the spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
Speech is a kind of medical supplement. The word is important here. So specifically, we see this transformation from his interest in kind of thinking about violence in the Taiping as sort of punishment and retribution for
decadence.
Exactly, decadence. To the Taiping then comes to his home province. And things kind of change for him a little bit. And this work, Man of Iron's Tears for Jiangnan, comes out of this. So can you talk about this work in this context? What's groovy about it? And how is what do we need to understand about this work to understand the larger work that you're doing with it?
Actually, the chapter comes out of that book, or that chapter comes out of a chance encounter with that book.
Mm-hmm.
I was starting to collect material related to the Taiping, and I was in China, and I was in the Beihai branch of the National Library of China, and I pulled all of the materials that were produced, all of the materials that might have a connection to my project, and I was flipping through, and I thought, oh my gosh, I have an illustrated history of the Taiping, and I wrote to the Library of Congress, said, "Do you have this?" And they said, "Oh, yes, we have it." And so I kind of put it aside. And I got back to Washington and I looked at it more carefully. And I thought, "Oh, this is amazing! This illustrated history of the Taiping, and the pictures are really compelling." We seldom, I think, we meaning people working on sort of elite visual culture in China, you seldom see vivid, direct representations of violence. And the pictures are vivid, direct representations of violence and suffering. And so even without looking at the words, you could see that this was going to be an important text. It was published under a pseudonym, so I didn't know who wrote it. But when I was at another library, I think it was at Columbia, I looked up the title to see if they had more information about the book than was on the card at the Library of Congress. And I think that's the sequence. And then anyway, I discovered that the cataloging at Columbia included the piece of information that the pseudonym was in fact a man named Yu Zhi. Mm-hmm. I went back to Washington, discovered that the Library of Congress in fact had Yu Zhi's chronological biography. It had his collected works, and it had the Tears from Jiangnan. And at that point, I thought, oh, that's a really, that's something that you could get your teeth into, right? So I started going through his essays. I did a rough out translation. And as I was reading, I realized that this wasn't an illustrated history of the Taiping. It was, in fact, kind of like a morality book. And that, in fact, it was a fundraising text. And that, in fact, it had multiple texts related to the Taiping events in the back that included a kind of call and response statement about how this was retribution. That had this incredible, I mean, call and response, it sounded like, if you read the text out loud, it sounded like a revival meeting. Mm. And the more I read about Shanshu, about morality books and philanthropy, I realized that it was part of this larger constellation of religious ideas that could be read as a response to the Taiping. So in that sense, it was through an effort to solve the mystery of what this text was and who this man was that that chapter came into being.
It's a fabulous chapter, and it's, we see this really, again, this really interesting, among the many other really fascinating things about this book and the chapter, we see this really interesting interplay here between image and text, mm-hmm. because you show us some examples where there's one where there's an image of, you know, violence and destruction and bodies being, that are, you know, dead and dismembered on the foreground, and then in the background, people reading a text on a wall, and that's almost like just as important as a mm-hmm. centerpiece of, so the interplay between text and image for anyone interested in that aspect of Qing sources is also really interesting here.
And actually, as you were talking about, as I call the chapter words, and he's interested in the spoken word and the written word, but he's also interested in the power of pictures. I mean, there's a reason that the text is illustrated. He believes in the mobilizing power of words, but in a sense, the audience for he sees the audience for words as limited, mm-hmm. and he places a very strong emphasis on the pedagogical function of pictures. And so we can see the ways in which the illustrations, which are so stunning if you come to them out of sort of elite visual culture, mm-hmm. it seems so strange. But if you come at it from the vantage point of thinking about illustrated primary school primers, for example, or illustrated texts that are designed to teach people how to be filial or teach people how to provide people with models for moral behavior. In point of fact, it's in that lineage, not the other lineage.
And it also, the nature of these illustrations, which do include words and bodies, brings us really nicely, I think, to the next chapter, because the book is very much a celebration of texts and sources and words, but it's also very much concerned with the bodies, mm-hmm. Material, physical, living and dead, commemorated and not, that are making up this landscape.
Yeah, and actually, I think of the book almost as three chapters about bodies framed by two very personal case studies.
Yeah, I can completely see that. And that worked really well. So the bodies in chapter three are marked bodies, and they're marked mm-hmm. in terms of physical markings on the flesh. They're marked by their hair. They're marked by their clothing, among other things. So you look, as part of the focus of this chapter, at the ways that, as you put it, wartime identities were formed and were also experienced and apprehended through tattoos, through hairstyle, and through clothing. So this is a fabulous kind of set of case studies for anyone interested in the history of bodies, identity, appearances, mm-hmm. And the very real political, social, and personal life and death consequences thereof. So let's talk about that for a little while. Tattooing. This is a really striking part of this story. So can you talk about the importance of tattooing in this context?
Actually, it's really funny because these are things that I didn't think that I needed to know about. But it turned out, I mean, I ended up learning a lot about specific practices, bodily practices and ways of thinking about living bodies in the Qing as a result of the research that I did for this chapter. the tattoos really, I mean, it's interesting how so much of the book comes out of being haunted by something that you find in a source, you know, and you come back to it later, but there's an image that just won't let go of you. So when I was in the Shanghai library, I called up a set of materials that turned out to be a manuscript of material related to a militia in southern Jiangsu province that had fought the Taiping. And it was their constitutional documents of how they got started, their communications with other, with other militias, and then a set of interrogations of captives that basically consisted of description of how they picked someone up on the road, they identified them, and then let them go with Qing papers, which is itself a kind of complicated phenomenon worth thinking about. But they pick up this guy, and he has the words Taiping Heavenly Kingdom tattooed on his face. And I thought about that. It was, how do you ever go home again? You know, what happens after the war ends? And just the visual image of someone with characters inscribed on their face. And then thinking about, like, what the face means. And thinking about all of the times you see in texts, like, if you're falsely accused, how would you have the face-to-face society? So the significance of the face as the self that you present to the world, and to have that marked, and the idea that tattooing is permanent. It's also associated, I learned in the course of doing the research. So anyway, I translated many of the descriptions of the people that were picked up on the road and let go. And I kind of had a feeling that that was a significant source in its own, would be a significant set of sources. But when thinking about it months later, I realized that the image that really stuck in my head was the image of this poor guy who gets picked up by a militia, and he's got the words Taiping Heavenly Kingdom. And ultimately they decide that even though he has these words on his face, he's an okay guy, and they let him go. But what are the consequences of that encounter? We can't know. There are a lot of things that we can't know, but what can we know about this person's experience generally, not specifically about this person? And so I started doing research on tattooing in Qing society. And actually, I didn't start the tattooing on Qing, in Qing society. I realized that in a lot of my other sources, especially the foreign sources, which are easy to kind of flip through, they almost reflexively mention the fact that they saw people with the words Taiping Heavenly Kingdom tattooed on their face. And then I realized that many of my Chinese sources were also referring to having these encounters. And then there's that stunning example in Li Gui's book of his own encounter with the tattooist, which is incredibly dramatic, maybe even dramatized, his anxiety about potentially being tattooed. So I realized this loomed really much larger than I had imagined in the primary source record. And so I thought, okay, I need to follow up on it. And I started doing research on tattooing as social practice in the Qing more generally, and coming up with a context for understanding what this meant.
That's interesting on so many levels. I mean, not just because it's just an extraordinarily striking practice, and from the perspective of the person being tattooed. And you mentioned in the chapter that captives who try to escape
are the ones that get marked.
Exactly. But also, I mean, from a different way into this set of issues as well, it really complicates what we think of as the history of inscription. Because if flesh can be a medium on which inscription of text is also, you know, an important part of this history, then it changes how we think about the history of inscriptions.
Well, just as a juxtaposition, right? One of the most famous stories of loyalism is UFA, the Southern Song loyalist, famously has text tattooed on his face. So you have people that are marked loyal and disloyal, marked criminal and loyal. So, yes, thinking of the human body as a vehicle for the manifestation of words.
Right. And so in the chapter, there's a ton of cases in here that, you know, we won't have a chance to talk about all of them, but I want to highlight just one other for listeners because it's such a fascinating part of the story. You talk about clothing being really important. You also talk about the importance of hair in this context. And that because your description of hair in this chapter kind of brings to the stage new kinds of characters, itinerant barbers, and sort of thinking about hair is not just, you know, perhaps a lot of us, when we read accounts of hair, when we think about hair, when we have a vision of hair in the Qing, it's the vision of, you know, the shaved pate and the queue. But hair in this chapter is changing, it's growing, it's it's got a life, it has movement, it really activates what we think of as hair, as not just being this flat two-dimensional image on the page of the shaved pate and the long queue. It really moves this.
And well, it also puts the shaved pate in time, because maintaining the shaved pate...
Can you talk about that in this context?
Sure. I mean, I think you're right. We think of the shaved pate, done deal, right? But your pate doesn't stay shaved, right? It requires constant policing in order to maintain its smooth texture. Okay, that sounds banal, right? I mean, men have to shave their faces every day to maintain their smooth skin. But, you know, so in ordinary times, it doesn't matter that much. It's part of daily life maintenance and personal hygiene. But in a time of political crisis, when, after all, the rebellion, the Taiping side gets referred to as, they're called the hair bandits. Right. And it doesn't mean they let their hair loose. It means they let their hair grow. I think that that's a common misunderstanding. It's that they, it's not that they loosened their braid. It's that they didn't shave the foreheads. And so it's the image of sort of sprouting hair on the forehead that marks one as a Taiping, not that you loosed the braid. And that, that was actually something that I was surprised to find, because we're conditioned to think of it as they let their queues out. It's not that they let their queues out. It's that they let their foreheads grow. And you see in the primary source text references to how many inches long the hair on the forehead had grown as being a mark of the level of commitment to the Taiping, or that how long the area had been occupied. And again, the striking image that this started from for me is there's a very kind of, very literary and dramatic memoir of One Man That gets published somewhat after the events, but it's his memoir of his experiences and his almost his adventures during this period. It's got the background of tragedy, but it's the story of his life experience in the foreground. And there are references to people who have to people going to Shanghai to do business, and they need to shave their head, but then they need to go home again, and they need to let, so like situating this in social time, situating hair growth in social time, realizing that in a time of political instability where territory is passing from Taiping to Qing and vice versa, and when people, in order to carry out the business of everyday life, need to move through territory carrying the right papers and with the right hairstyle, you realize that that actually adds a level of challenge to everyday experience. It's part of that everyday life.
That's right. Thank you. So not only do we have living bodies that are growing and changing, we also have dead bodies in this story. And those dead bodies are also being broken down into parts in some cases, and they are changing, and they are taking on different kinds of significance. So chapter 4 looks at what happened to dead bodies in Jiangnan, and it asks, or it kind of opens up a series of questions and starts responding to those questions, including, you know, where were the dead bodies put?
That was one of the starting questions for the book as a whole, right? If there are 20 to 30 million dead bodies, what does that mean in terms of social practice? What do you do? And especially in a society that places such a high importance on modes of burial and commemoration.
Right, exactly. And this is, again, one of the many ways that the book takes what might be on the page just a number that we think about on reflection, just like, you know, thinking about the shaved plate is just static, and really bringing it to life and bringing death to life in a really material everyday sense. So when you have thousands or tens of thousands of bodies, and they're bodies of husbands, of wives, of children, of loved ones, and they are physical and they are there and they take up space, what do you do and what did they do? So the chapter really looks at not just, as you call it, the political symbolism of corpses, but also the materiality of corpses and the ways that they changed. So there are many things in this chapter that are happening. There are corpses being dismembered and taken and being sold, possibly as food in markets. There are also corpses that are being miraculously preserved. So let's talk about human flesh and markets just briefly, cannibalism. I mention this because this tends to be, there's a way of treating cannibalism in Chinese texts that's very sensational, and that's not what this book does. It's not what this chapter does. So can you talk about the importance of cannibalistic practice in the context of this book and kind of your approach to that and what you were trying to do with that here and how maybe that's, you know, complicates how we think of cannibalism in this history?
Let me think about that for a minute, because actually that's the material that I think people found most uncomfortable when I presented it before I wrote the book. With good reason, cannibalism makes people feel uncomfortable, and there are sort of theoretical expectations that need to be met with regard to cannibalism, because, you know, in sort of the standard line on that is that, you know, cannibalism is something that foreign observers impose on other societies, and it seemed to me and what do we mean when we talk about cannibalism in China? But looking at the primary source record, it seemed to me that cannibalism was being used in two ways, that it really very much, and actually the whole set of discourses around dead bodies more generally and cannibalism specifically is a kind of moral political. It operates in a moral political register, right? So it's a way of measuring how bad to talk about cannibalism is to talk about the total moral breakdown of society or the near total moral breakdown of society, and it fits into larger discourses about filial piety and loyalty and sort of what a well-functioning society would look like. And cannibalism becomes a mechanism for talking about the obliteration of moral norms and total political and moral breakdown. And so you see the ways in which anonymous stories and rumors of cannibalism function in that way. On the other hand, you also see references to survival cannibalism that are appearing in places where they don't have that heavy moral weight attached to them. In a kind of matter-of-fact way, someone records in their diary that human flesh was for sale at a certain price. Interestingly, as one of my colleagues pointed out, if there are markets functioning, that signals that it's less than total breakdown. Mm-hmm. Because you know, in order for a market to function, there has to be at least a modicum of social order. So that is a sort of strange aspect of the way the stories get told. So you get it really in two registers. One, as sort of a practical matter of fact, human flesh was for sale in the markets, or you get this is a signifier of how terrible things were. And you see that, for example, in Yuzhi's Tears for Jiangnan text. There's an illustration of human flesh for sale, and it's something that has a place of origin. People from Yixing specifically are accused of eating human flesh, and then the practice spreads. That's very much in the moral register.
It's in the moral register, but at the same time, one of the things that I really love about the way you're treating cannibalism and cannibalistic practice in this book, and this is coming from someone who's written about cannibalism and, you know, in the Ming or in Ming texts, is the book really changes, at least changed for me, the way I think about that, because it's not just presented in the book as, you know, cannibalism, ism, like the moral, it's a set of material practices that are written about in terms that are related to markets, to butchery. I mean, when you have an illustration of someone physically butchering meat, that's just a very different way into this this history that doesn't, put it in necessarily explicitly isms kind of terms.
Yeah, and I think I think for me, one of the things I really wanted to do with the book is to take this set of events that has been forced into isms, mm-hmm. and put it back in the realm of everyday experience and practice, because those everyday experiences and practices animate the primary source record.
That's right. And so to sort of get further into the descriptions and discussions of bodies, you also talk about, and I won't ask you to talk too much about this, purely in the interest of letting you get back to the rest of the conference at some point later on today. But I will mention you do talk about cases of and accounts of miraculously preserved bodies. And so mm-hmm. I mention this because for listeners who may not think of themselves as inherently interested in Qing China, but who are interested in stories of preservation of the flesh saints' bodies, mm-hmm. relics. This is actually a really interesting
point of comparison,
exactly, in really, really interesting ways, both in terms of the language used, but also in terms of the kinds of accounts.
It's also really striking to me the ways in which sort of religious ideas permeate people's responses to these events. Because mm-hmm. I think there's a tendency to frame this as Taiping religion versus something else, but seeing the ways in which people mm-hmm. responded to these events using religious vocabularies. So preservation of the body as a political religious response, but also at these events, we tend to think of Chinese conservatism or Confucian conservatism as something that goes way back. But I think that there are ways in which these events transformed and conditioned late 19th century religious, political, moral ideas that we consider under the rubric of Confucianism. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, the post-Taiping period is a very particular, or the post-Taiping version of Confucianism, mm-hmm. and I'm using flash quotes here, but you
right.
can't see them.
Right, we're using scare quotes.
It's very much a product of the backlash against Taiping iconoclasm. Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you. And it's another really important way of reframing the way, as you mentioned, or as you've alluded to, we typically think of the Taiping Rebellion, right? Those religious...
Either if you think of them, those Christians or those, you know, sort of iconoclasts or, you know,
exactly.
that freakish man who thought he was Jesus Christ's
exactly.
younger brother versus
rationality. Exactly.
And there are ways in which the very category of rationality is itself problematic.
Yes.
And there are ways in which we need to remember that Chinese elites had religious lives.
That's right. And so this comes up in this chapter in the case of these preservation of flesh, and also in the case of, and I won't ask you to talk too much about this because just so that we can move on to the next chapter, but there's also a really interesting treatment of philanthropic organizations mm-hmm. that take over the project of burying the dead. And so you talk about the implications of this and the implications not just locally, but also dynastically. And this interplay and this sort of co-constitutional relationship between the local and the dynastic is very much something that takes center stage in the following chapter. So let's turn to that. Wood and ink. Chapter 5 focuses on efforts to commemorate the dead in wood and in ink, in shrines that are actually built structures and also in books. And you talk about the various ways in which post-war commemoration of the dead was really crucial, and crucial in particular for local communities. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a really nice place to pull out this aspect of the book, this sort of tension between the local and then the dynastic. Okay, so with the Taiping, commemoration of the dynasty's dead, as you put it in the book, becomes a local local project. And what's happening is at the same time, people are seeking imperial sanction for these efforts, but at the same time, they're deploying Qing institutions to their own purposes. And this is happening in the context of diminishing state authority and increasing local power. So can you talk about that relationship, the sort of this co-constitution, but also tension between the dynastic and the local in terms of commemoration of the dead?
I think you've just done a wonderful job summarizing it, actually.
Or like some ways that you think, what do you think is really important about what's happening in this chapter for you that really sticks out?
You know, I think in some ways I think historians have understood for a while, at least since Mary Rankin's work on the elites of Zhejiang, the formation of post-Taiping elite organizations to carry out some of the functions formerly carried out by government. We've known that we've thought in terms of the devolution of state authority onto local managerial elites. And one of the things I wanted to do with the book is to show the ways in which these rationalizing local managerial elites have religious lives and respond in ways that I think we can think of as sort of religiously, as religious and emotional, but also thinking in terms of the ways in which the very tasks caused by, or the tasks that were needed in the very particular context of the war, like burying and commemorating the dead, devolved onto local elites. But again, this is not an opposite. We've tended to want to think of this as state-society oppositional relationships, but I think of them as kind of both symbiotic and in tension. So they're in some ways making use of dynastic institutions to their own particular local purposes. Mm-hmm. And so we need to see it in both contexts, and we need to see the ways in which the dynasty and the emperor remain powerful sources of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. They are imagined as being necessary to the function of local society. It's at the same time imaginatively essential, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that they're dissenting, but they are not using those institutions in quite exactly the ways in which they were intended when they were set up by the dynasty in the 18th century.
So how does this, because part, one of the, among the many things that are wonderful about the book, one of the really interesting things we've talked about is the range of sources. Right? Mm-hmm. And you talk here not just about now textual sources or textual monuments, but about built structures.
Yes.
So how does this kind of maybe co-production or tension play out in the terms of built structures in this book?
Oh, wow. You know, that would take a long time to answer, I think.
So you use a particular example here of a manifest loyalty shrine.
Sure.
So maybe we can talk about that example a little bit. Or in particular, as I take a sip of water, what went into, if I were, for example, I'm in Hangzhou and I want to build a manifest loyalty shrine.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do?
Well, you need to work cooperatively with the magistrate. So you need permission from the magistrate in order to... The institutionally, these relationships... The Manifest Loyalty Shrine is an institution set up to honor the dynasty's dead. And in the chapter, I really walk through the kind of codified, canonical, the changing official line on the structure and function of these manifest loyalty shrines and how they move from being a central Beijing institution to being something that is supposed to happen in every administrative center, and how they go from honoring people who supported the dynasty, who supported the dynasty in the moment of its founding, right? So the military accomplishments of those who were involved in the dynastic founding to something that spreads. And this is documentable in legal texts. Mm-hmm. And it spreads from the center to the provinces. It spread, and the category, the dynasty's dead, expands from its original military association to being accessible to commoners who die in the name of the dynasty, right? And that happens before these events, but it takes on new meaning and expands exponentially as very large numbers of civilians die in ways that are retrospectively construed as making them qualified for state honors.
Right. Again, one more way, really kind of building up and transforming through this process the what locality is and who gets to count.
Sure. And actually, it becomes a kind of three-part dynamic between the regional armies that won the war, mm-hmm. who want to build, whose officers then become high-ranking officials in Jiangnan after the war, mm-hmm. during and after the war, actually, and who then the dynasty itself, and local elites. And so you see different ways of, you see the same types of institutions being deployed to honor different categories of dead, and you can see some of the ways in which the relationship among the regional armies, the dynasty itself, and the local elites emerges out of this conflict in tension, mm-hmm. and also as symbiotic.
Great, thank you. So as we come to the last, well, not the last chapter, but sort of this framing chapter, the last case study, as you've mentioned before, the structure of the book really nicely is kind of bounded by these two studies of words, and we've got bodies in the middle. So we've talked about Yuzhi, we've talked about these three chapters that take us sequentially.
Dead bodies and honored bodies.
Exactly, exactly. And so now we come at the end, or at least to the last case study, to chapter 6, Lost. Or loss. So chapter 6 focuses on one man's text that honors his murdered mother. This is Zhang Guanglie, and he produces this text called A Record of 1861, which is a memorial to his mother, which is itself, again, from the perspective of someone who really loves texts and sources, a really fascinating document or series of documents. You talk about this in terms of a book of fragments, right? Mm-hmm. So can you just explain this guy in this text for us. What's going on here, and what's exciting to you about this text?
Sure.
That focuses this chapter?
Again, the fortuitousness of research. Again, I was in a library. I was at the Stanford East Asia Library, pulling out whatever I could find that related to this period. Record of 1861 sounds kind of like a banal title, but I photocopied the book and it was sort of in a pile on my desk. And after I finished working with the Yuzhi material and had done some of the other, done the commemorative work, I happened to start filing my materials and I picked up that photocopy, not really understanding what it was. And I started reading the introduction, and it really kind of made my hair stand up. I mean, it's such a powerful piece, and it opens in a really powerful way. I mean, basically, this adult man writing about how he can't let go of his memories, how he is haunted. And, I mean, I'm paraphrasing because I can't access the exact quote, but it was something to the effect of, it's really nice that the dynasty has chosen to honor my mother, but her sons and grandsons feel a pain that can never be forgotten. Mm-hmm. And so I started just translating the text and trying to figure out what it was, which is, it doesn't really match our standard generic catalog of what something might be. It includes both the official documents and materials related to the dynastic honors bestowed on his mother. It also includes his mother's story culminating with her death, and it repeatedly comes back to that moment of death, mm-hmm. each with a slightly different valence. There's a section on the time of her death. There's an entry on the place of her death. There's a list of bestowed lessons to her descendants that combines very particular memories, like of being held by his mother as a toddler and being called by his baby name, or lying across his mother's lap and having her drip food and wine in. And so the combination of the formal and the informal, the fragmentary, and especially the sensory.
Can you talk about that? Yeah, that's because for me, I'll jump in here and just mark the fact that that was really striking to me as well, because she's smoking a pipe. He talks about the pock marks on her face.
The things that make her, on the one hand, he talks about the things that make her legible as a moral being, but he also talks about the very particular and textural feelings and attributes that make her an individual, and the things that for him marked his relationship. And they're always relayed in almost photographic moments, not a narrative. It really, when we think back on our own childhoods, it is through that moment looking out the window, and you don't necessarily have a handle on the context, but you remember the first time you saw a rainbow out the window, and you remember where you were, and you felt, that kind of immediacy. And so he really captures the tactile aspects of their relationship. And it's a really hair-raising text, because you read it with an awareness of how special she was to him. And there are also really creepy moments in the text.
When his sister possesses the concubine.
Yeah, his dead sister. He is a very small boy, and he witnesses his mother's death and is somehow rescued by a family servant and carried across rural Zhejiang, and he describes what it was like to walk and see and how they ate, and it's incredibly powerful text. He's then somehow reconnected with his father and ends up in Guangzhou. One of the things that's so tactile is he a lot of his memory resides in the fact that he had a skin ailment as a child, and he picks his scabs, and his mother told him his scabs were special, and his sister used to scratch him in a particular way. So he's in Guangzhou, and suddenly, another key piece of information is that his siblings are taken away. His mother is murdered and his siblings taken away. And he doesn't know what's become of them. And he's in Guangzhou, and the spirit of his sister starts speaking, or he apprehends the spirit of his sister speaking through his father's concubine. And he knows it's her because of the particular way that she picks his scabs for him.
Right.
And the voice of his sister tells the family that she died an honorable death. So the spirit speaking becomes a conduit for asserting the morality of the sister. But on the other hand, you feel it in a very kind of human and tactile way.
I'm getting chills. I know. I'm imagining the scene.
And there are several moments in the story where he describes seeing the face of his mother, or the form of his mother, superimposed on the servants or on his wife, and a servant who remembered his mother reinforces the fact that indeed his wife looks more like his mother than the official portrait of his mother that his father made for her, for in her honor, and also the recovery of the mother's body so that she can be properly buried again through divine intervention.
Right.
And there were so many moments for me, what was so powerful is the kind of juxtaposition of the formal and official, the patriarchal and the informal, the informal, the personal, the individual,
intimate.
The intimate. So they're not exclusive,
right.
But on the other hand, you can feel the different registers of meaning associated with these categories that we think of as somehow incompatible.
Right, and it's also, and as we come to the kind of conclusion of our conversation, as a way of framing the book, there's this really beautiful arc that takes us from one context in which there's, you know, one person's writing and we see writing about bodies. It takes us through then a story about that brings us into the history of and with bodies in different ways and different registers, so that by the time we get to this last case study, which is also about, you know, a text about bodies in the Taiping, these are now very different ways of apprehending mm-hmm. and writing about. And there's this kind of increasing intimacy and materiality that really creates this really wonderful arc, I think, in terms of the reading process.
And actually, in terms of the research process, I presented the work on Zhang Guanglian, and one of my graduate students said, well, how do we know that he existed other than in the story he told about himself and his mother? How do we find out that he really existed? And I puzzled over that for a long time. Mm-hmm. Right? How do we know that a person is real or that their experience is real? And by fortuitous chance, our school library acquired the Shenbao, the Chinese newspaper keyword searchable database. Mm-hmm. And I typed in his name and out popped two articles by him and three places where his name got mentioned. And so I was able to kind of put together more of a biographical understanding of who he was.
That's great. And that also lets me mention a really nice segue that the last chapter endings, we won't talk about it purely in the interest of time, but it does talk about the importance of sources like the Shenbao, like newspapers, and also brings sort of to a conclusion, a discussion of other really important sources, many of which we've talked about in different ways over the course of our conversation, for not just understanding, but revisioning and re-conceptualizing and re-encountering this period.
And actually, it's interesting because these media, like the Shenbao, like newspapers, like published memoirs, like lithography in Shanghai, not only produce sources for us and new ways of apprehending these events for us, but I think they also produce new ways of understanding and processing experience for people who lived those experiences in the past. Certainly, the production and circulation of knowledge about these events shaped the way people understood what they had experienced and then shaped the way that these events were remembered. For example, the construction of shrines and the editing of martyrologies reframed these events as events of, in official terms, as good guys and bad guys, right? With the Qing as the good guys and the Taiping as the bad guys, and that gets reversed as the dynasty comes to an end, and actually fuels some of the anti-dynastic rage with images of the anti-dynastic activism of the Taiping. But also these kinds of local experiences are there for us to find as we re-encounter the stories through these primary source texts that circulated in new media and new ways of documenting past experience, personal experience.
So Toby, thank you. I've taken up a lot of your time already. The book is extraordinarily rich and we've only barely scratched the surface. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners and perhaps particularly for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it? Anything that sort of seems really important, but that you want to mention, but that we didn't have time for?
No, I mean, I think you've done a really good job of drawing out both the experience of writing the book and what's actually in it. So thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I hope listeners will go and read the book, because as I hope is abundantly clear, it's a fabulous book. At least I think it's fabulous.
Thank you.
And so now that the book is out, congratulations on it. Are there any, what's next for you? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you? Can you imagine where you want to go next?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I think that in terms of loose end, there are a couple of little pieces that are still haunting me from the book. One is I'm really still very fascinated by Li Gui, the author of A History of Pain, who wrote this very dramatic memoir of his experience as a Taiping captive and the juxtaposition of so he traveled around the world to go to the Philadelphia Expo in 1876 and returns and writes a memoir of his experiences of his journey to the West. And then he writes this memoir of his experience 3 years as a Taiping captive. And the juxtaposition of those two texts still fascinates me, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do with that and what light that will shed on his autobiography of his experience as a Taiping captive. But I'm interested in that, maybe as something that's accessible to a wider range of readers, and for what it says about the 19th century moment and the confluence of different sets of events, or events that we tend to think of as different sets of events. And then I was asked to do a talk on gardens as social spaces, mm-hmm. and sort of thinking about gardens during the Taiping Rebellion, and so at least an article length project. And one of the interesting things that ends up in that article would be one is the ways in which gardens become a site for talking about mother son relationships, which was, again, a surprising finding. And we see that John Wong Liat builds a garden to commemorate his mother as one of, in addition to the text, he also builds and loses a garden. But also a guy in Yangzhou has a painting made of his mother's lost garden as a way of consoling and comforting her for her loss. So this idea of garden as grand gesture of filial piety. I'm waiting for my son to build me my garden. sort of gardens as sites of loss, commemoration, thinking about gardens as property. And I just published an article about a primary, one of these little memoirs that I cited in the book, but again, it like lingered in my mind. About a grain merchant in Hefei who documents his sort of spatial trajectories through the city, imagining his own suicide.
Wow.
And I just published that in Frontiers of History in China in December. So little bits and pieces, but I think I'm still really interested in, again, this dynamic of material object and text and accessing lived experience through different literary genres. Yeah.
Well, sounds great. And thank you again, Toby. It's really been a pleasure, and congratulations again on the
Thank
book.
You so much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.